This is an interview with Dr. Sam Seltzer on May 23rd, 1977 for the Oral History Project on Endodontics. One, two.
Okay. What I'd like to do to find out a little bit initially is what kind of a background you came from, your education, how you got into endodontics, you had to work your way through, or things of that nature.
I see. Well, I came from a immigrant Russian family background, although I was born in the United States. My parents were hardworking, frugal people, and education was very important in our family. I had a brother and sister, and we all went to college. And I don't recall ever really having a desire to get into dentistry per se. And about my senior year in high school, I still didn't know what career I wanted to pursue. But it was an interesting thing in our family. We had a dentist who was the only professional man in the family, and he was well respected by the family. And one day he asked me what my future plans were, and I told him I didn't know. And he suggested dentistry as a career. And since the family looked up to him, and I did too, I decided to pursue dentistry as a career, and I was admitted to dental school. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and both undergraduate and professional school, and I think I had a good dental education there, but my interest in endodontics didn't develop until after I graduated from dental school. In my junior and senior year at Penn, I was very taken with Dr. Appleton, who at that time was head of the Department of Bacteriology. And I viewed him as a scholar and a very knowledgeable individual, and his approach to dentistry was a very important influence in my life at that particular time, because he was a very keen observer of life in general, and then, one of the foremost authorities in bacteriology, and I got interested in bacteriology at the time. It was one of the scientific disciplines that we were exposed to. But not in endodontics per se, because endodontics was not a specialty, and as a matter of fact, there was very little that was done that was scientific in endodontics. Now, I might be rambling a bit, but I just recalled my first experiences in endodontics as an undergraduate in the senior year. I think we did two cases. We had a very nice gentleman called Dr. Cragen, who was our instructor, and I hadn't the faintest idea what endodontics was all about. As a matter of fact, of course, in those days we called it root canal therapy. And Dr. Cragen was the single teacher in the department, although it wasn't a separate department, it was part of operative dentistry. And I think he came in to school about a day and a half a week. And he ran the entire endodontic treatment center, if we can call it that. And I very vividly recall his using a caustic alloy. It was called sodium potassium alloy, which is, I don't think is available today. It was somewhat like a styptic pencil. And it was very dramatic. You took a little bit of that white paste off the pencil and on a bar brooch, placed it in the root canal. When it came in contact with moisture, it sparked. And it was very dramatic. Sparks flew out of the tooth. The tooth seemed to be on fire, and you got the feeling it was killing off all the bacteria in there. Actually, what happened was the the sodium and potassium alloy, when in contact with moisture, formed hydroxides, which were powerful caustics. And I remember we used acids to soften and probably to irrigate the root canal. Sulfuric acid, I remember, was being used. And I think, but I'm not absolutely sure, that Dr. Cragen taught the Callahan method of treating and filling root canals. But I knew absolutely nothing about what I was doing or why I was doing it. And as a matter of fact, the cases that I treated, I think Dr. Cragen did for me rather than my doing it myself. But I was interested, as a result of Dr. Appleton's influence in microbiology, and I soon became interested in cavity sterilization. I wondered what was the best agent to use in sterilizing cavities, because we were using phenol at the time, and some men were using silver nitrate, and others were using thymolin alcohol, and there were various other drugs. Beechwood creosote, I remember, was another. And it seemed to me that there ought to be one which was better than the other. Now, we knew nothing at all about the effect of these medicaments on the pulp. There was nothing in the literature about that, as I can recall. But we were interested in, at least I was, in which one was the best one to use, which one would kill off all the organisms. So I remember going to Dr. Appleton and proposing a study of culturing the dentine shavings from the cavity and then applying as a control, and then applying a medicament for a short period of time, and then culturing again to see how efficacious the sterilizing agent was. And to my surprise, I found that silver nitrate was always considered to be such a powerful sterilizing agent. It wasn't sterilizing the dentine at all. As a matter of fact, the study went on for quite a long period of time, and in some cases they even sealed the cavities off for up to a year, and found about one third of the cases that organisms persisted up to a year afterwards, which was sort of a startling revelation, since I always thought that if you put an antibacterial dressing in the tooth, you would kill off organisms. The stronger the antiseptic was, the more organisms would be killed. And as a matter of fact, at that time, the standard was the phenol coefficient, I think they called it. You compared everything against phenol, which was the standard medicament. You knew that that would kill a certain number of organisms within a specific period of time. So everything was compared to phenol. But even phenol didn't sterilize the cavities. And as a matter of fact, we came away with a feeling that no medicament would really sterilize. Following the completion of that experiment, I was so impressed with the results, and so was Dr. Appleton, that we went to the head of the operative department at Penn at that time, is a man called Arthur Gable. And he was a physicist, and his main concern in operative was the amount, the force that would be delivered to the cavity during gold foil plugging, things like that. He wasn't really a biologist. But we presented him with the evidence and said, look, excuse me, all the drugs that we're using to sterilize cavities are not really working. Why should we use them at all? And he agreed with that, and shortly thereafter, they eliminated the so-called cavity sterilization from operative dentistry. So I felt real good about that. At any rate, that was in the early part of my career, and that was as close as I came to being interested or involved in endodontics. Strangely enough, I became interested in endodontics, I guess, seriously about the...
Let me interrupt you for a minute.
All right.
When was this that you were going through dental school?
This was in the 1937, and I did the experiments, continued with the experiments until 1939. Then in 1940, I went into the Army, and I was away for 5 years. When I came back, I was very much interested in getting back into the academic environment, and nonetheless, I went into general practice, and I taught part-time and practiced most of the time. And at that time, Dr. Grossman at the University of Pennsylvania had come on the scene as head of the Department of Endodontics at that time. I think it was not still a separate department, it was part of oral medicine. But he was, as you know, a very dynamic individual, and had a great impact on the field. I also met I.B. Bender at that time. This was in the late 40s, as I can recall. And I wanted to teach at Penn. There was no opening in the endodontic section of the operative, so I taught in the operative department for a couple of years. And when I met Bender, we seemed to have a mutual interest in investigation and research. And at that time, antibiotics were coming into the forefront. As you know, penicillin had been discovered by Fleming in the 30s and had been used with increasing effectiveness during the war, World War II, so that it seemed natural that sooner or later someone would begin to use it in endodontic therapy for sterilizing root canals. And Dr. Grossman was in the forefront of these investigations, and Bender was too, initially with penicillin alone, and they soon realized, both Grossman and Bender, that you couldn't really sterilize a cavity with penicillin alone because it only hit the gram-positive organisms. So Grossman very cleverly figured out a combination of antibiotics which he thought would cover the entire spectrum of the organisms that were known to be present in the root canal. And that's how the famous PBSC formula came into being. That was penicillin, bacitracin, streptomycin, and sodium caprylate. Obviously, from the logical standpoint, this would hit the gram-positive, the gram-negative organisms, and the yeast, and any other organisms that fell by the way, that weren't killed by the other ingredients. Logically, that seemed to make a lot of sense, but from a practical standpoint, it didn't work because there were still many organisms which were not affected by the mixture. And although it didn't occur initially at the time, subsequent to that, we began to realize that many individuals could be sensitized by local applications of small quantities of antibiotics, and that was not a good thing. However, unbeknownst to me at the time, but subsequently, as I became more interested in endodontics, I became aware of the fact that we did go through a biologic era in endodontics in the early 40s. And this was influenced by men like Coolidge and Blaney and Hatton and Skillen and Mohn. And as we look back on the literature of the times, we realize that these men were quite biologically oriented. As a matter of fact, I remember being very impressed by when I read a paper of Roy Blaney's, which was published, as I can recall, in the late 30s or early 40s, somewhere in that era. And it was entitled The Biologic Aspects of Endodontics. And if we read this paper today, it fairly well encompasses all the basic principles that we practice endodontics by. And our thinking today is very similar. Strangely, it had very little impact, except among a few, in endodontics at the time, I think primarily because of the influences of men like Grossman and Bender and Sommer and Ostrander and Crowley out in the Midwest, who were interested in the microbiological aspects of endodontics. And they were vying with each other to find out which drugs or drug combinations could be used to reduce the number of visits that one could get in which one could get a negative culture for the root canal. And I like to call that the alphabet era because there's so many different combinations that were promulgated as being effective sterilizing agents. And the main emphasis at that time was the relationship of microbiology to endodontics, and that seemed to be the key. Grossman's influence here was very forceful, and it was an outgrowth of the era that we'd gone through in the early 20s, which is referred to as the Hunterian era. I mean, Hunter came out with what was apparently a devastating condemnation of dentistry, where he found that the teeth which were crowned, he called cesspools of infection. And this was taken to imply that teeth could be foci of infection. And as a result, We went through a blood bath, and the teeth were extracted wholesale, and many times for no good reason other than they might act as sources of infection. Now, Grossman's influence was to counteract that and to show in a scientific way, that the root canals need not be sources of infection. And how could you show that? Of course, if you showed that microbiologically the canals could be sterilized, then you couldn't think, you didn't have to think of teeth as foci of infection. There was justification for saving them. So Grossman's influence was vast in this area, and unfortunately, one of the outgrowths of this kind of thinking was to completely ignore the biologic aspects of what was happening to the tissue periapically when you put drugs and medicaments in the root canals. How did the repair take place? And our endodontists here in the United States paid no attention to this whatsoever. Then along about, I guess it must be in the early 50s, a dynamic, brilliant Scandinavian burst on the American scene. His name was Nygaard Osby. And as a matter of fact, he first came to the United States at the first international conference on endodontics that was sponsored by Dr. Grossman in Philadelphia. I believe it was 1952. Nygaard Osby was a brilliant man. He was head of the Norwegian Institute of Dental Research. He had done a tremendous amount of investigation in endodontics, and he presented his findings at this first conference, and they were startling in that for the first time we were able to see block sections of teeth, the apexes of teeth and the surrounding tissues in correct perspective. And we could see that there was something going on there periapically that American endodontists simply hadn't thought about. We were always concerned with bugs and drugs. Suddenly we realized that there was more going on than just sterilizing root canals. As a matter of fact, Nygaard Osby made no mention whatsoever of sterilization procedures. All he showed us was, in a series of block sections, that reactions were taking place periapically to all the endodontic procedures. And he showed us a lot of lesions periapically that resulted from instrumentation, from root canal fillings, cements that were pushed beyond the apex, and he showed us cases that were repaired. Well, I think that Osby's influence, I should say Nygaard Osby, was absolutely tremendous on the American thinking, although it took a long, long period of time before we began to think to get away from strictly the microbiological aspects of endodontics and into the what we call the biological era. In actuality, the biological era, which came into being in the late 60s, middle to late 60s, was really a reflection of what had been going on in the late 30s and early 40s for men like Coolidge and Blaney, and then later Nygaard Osby. But it took a long time for those influences to surface because of the tremendous controversies that existed between the Midwestern school, of which Osby and Summer and Ostrander and Crowley were the heads, and the Eastern school, of which Grossman was the head, where they were fighting with each other all the time about the relative efficacies of antibiotics versus standard germicides and sterilizing root canals. And I think that sort of wasted a lot of time and energy in endodontics, and as a result, no real good research in endodontics took place in the United States, in my opinion, for the next 10 or 15 years. All the research was related to the bacterial flora in the root canal and the drugs that would kill off this flora. None whatsoever to the effects of either the organisms or the medicaments on the periapical tissues. And then after that, we got involved in a lot of technical phases, and how you fill the root canal became a very important key. And we went through phases here. We're using single cones, namely silver cones were very popular initially. later gutta percha. And then once gutta percha became popular in the United States, a lot of concentration on how to insert it, whether it be by lateral condensation or vertical condensation, the so-called warm gutta percha technique and so on. We spent a lot of time, I think, unnecessarily in endodontics in the past 10 years worrying about methods of insertion of root canal fillings, which I think will fall by the wayside after a while. That is, not that filling root canals will fall by the wayside, but I think we'll develop methods of inserting root canal fillings, which will be a hell of a lot simpler than the methods that we have now, which are exceedingly time-consuming. So, to summarize what I've been saying is that I view endodontics as really in its infancy from the standpoint of the scientific or biologic era. We're in it now. We're just beginning to investigate the tissue reactions in a more complete way. We're beginning to find out that we have both cell-mediated and humoral immunity involved. We're beginning to find a lot more about the inflammatory response than we ever knew before. We're finding that our lesions have the inflammatory cells, which are present in other lesions elsewhere in the body, that we are manufacturing antibodies here. Recent studies indicate that we have complement present in the periacral lesion, so that I think a whole new era will open up in which we'll begin to examine the reactions to various antigens in the root canal, which will differ probably, and how to deal with those reactions on a clinical level, not only from the standpoint of making the patients feel more comfortable, but also in terms of stimulating repair. I think we still have a way to go in terms of pain control in endodontics. We've got to learn how to make our patients feel very comfortable and not to fear endodontics. And as this comes about, of course, eventually we've got to really work toward eliminating ourselves as a specialty, because prevention really is the keynote to the future of all health sciences. So I think this is around the corner, and not in the immediate future, of course, but it seems pretty obvious that as caries itself is beaten, if we develop a vaccine or by whatever method, there'll be less and less need for endodontics. And that's as it should be. Every profession should work toward self-destruction, which is the ultimate. So that's rather a long-winded background, I think, of endodontics. What else would you like to know?
Okay. What did your endodontic education consist of? And say, was there a formal specialty program at the time you got into it? Was it a preceptor type of thing? What memories do you have of your early few cases?
Mm-hmm. Well, I sort of got into that very briefly in the beginning of the statement, and I got off on myself. I'm not saying it's because of modesty. I'm not going to claim any false modesty. At the same time, as I was mentioning that, I realized that I had practically no contribution to endodontics other than the initial work that began with Bender in the late 40s. We were trying to find an antifungal medicament because we were running into a lot of yeast. Both he and I individually were running into a lot of yeast in the root canal. And we were looking for an antifungal antibiotic. We began to test various fungicides, and we found that we had a mutual interest. And we did a few papers on the work that we did at the time. We found that quaternary ammonium agents were effective but seemed to be toxic. And that really didn't lead us anywhere. And nonetheless, we were able to see that we did have mutual interests in the field. At that time, I was in general practice, and there were very few endodontists in the United States, in the world, in fact. There were certainly no formal training programs. Bender also was in general practice, and we continued in general practice and continued to work together, research-wise, for several years. My interest in endodontics came about in a peculiar fashion. I was in general practice, I've indicated, and I was very busy by this time. This was in the mid-50s. I'd built up a fairly good practice. I had a friend who was an orthodontist. That is, he was interested in orthodontics, but he was in general practice as well. And one day, he asked me if I would be interested in taking his endodontic cases and doing them for him, because he realized I had an interest in the pulp. In a vague way, I did, because of the cavity sterilization experiments. And I agreed to do that. So I saw a few of his patients and a few of my own, and I began to realize that this was a field which was, from a psychological standpoint, an exceedingly important one. It began to slowly dawn on me that saving teeth was an extremely important service. At that time, predominant courses in postgraduate education were courses on how to extract teeth and how to replace them. That is, oral surgery and prosthodontics were the most popular postgraduate courses. In endodontics, I think if a course was given in endodontics, it was probably no more than a few handful of people that attended. Yet, I was very impressed with the fact that when patients wanted to save their teeth, they would go to almost any extreme to do so. And even though I fumbled around and didn't know what I was doing, I knew that we had to ream out the canal somehow. And I knew we had to sterilize them, and then I knew we had to fill them. I hadn't the vaguest conception of how this was to be done. I fumbled through it, and I'm sure that even Grossman and Summer and the leading lights at the time were also fumbling their way through and developing techniques that were good for them, that they were comfortable with. But there was no real scientific basis for the techniques. It just seemed that you developed one that worked for you and you used it. However, I was greatly influenced by Grossman's approach, and that seemed to make a lot of sense. And he taught me that we should enlarge canals in a stepwise manner, going from the smallest sized instrument up to the largest, and then using reamers and files in successive order. You know, use a number one reamer, then a number one file, then a number two reamer, then a number two file, and then eventually enlarge that way, and once in a while backtracking as you were packing shavings at the apex of the tooth. And our criteria for completion of the instrumentation were removal of clean white shavings from the root canal, which is more or less the standard even today. Well, I started to get interested in doing endodontics primarily because, as I said, the psychological appeal that it had for me in saving teeth for patients, it made me feel good. And I began to realize one other thing, which slowly dawned on me, and now I'm absolutely convinced that it's correct. And that is that, well, the patients would